We want to continue our lesson, Biology Without Darwin, part two tonight. And to begin with, I want to review very quickly some of the things that we covered last week so that we can move on from that spot. Now, the evolutionists say that life evolved over 65 million years ago, that it started out as a one-celled animal and then became more and more complex as it gained information. Well, that's the big problem. How did it gain information? But in their everyday work, biologists find that evolution really plays no part. They can study the attributes of plants and animals and their interactions without any reference to evolution at all. And yet evolution is touted as the basis for all biology. So the problem is, there's no legitimate explanation to explain how evolution occurred. An evolutionist stated it this way. He said, how did stupid atoms spontaneously write their own software, and where did this particular form of information come from to get the first cell up and running? Nobody knows. So even evolutionists have to admit that they really don't have an answer for how this works. They just say, it happened. Now, the explanation usually given, because, you know, somebody's going to ask, well, if that's true, how did it happen? The explanation usually given is, well, mutation occurred. Mutation is when the genetic code has an error in it. And it happens. It's fairly rare, but it does happen. Something may get substituted, or something may get inserted, or something may get left out of the genetic code, and it changes the appearance or the function of something in that particular animal. It never changes what the animal is. It just changes something about it. There have been fruit fly mutations in eyes and without wings. There have been mutations where something had, say, two heads. Or there have been mutations where instead of antennas, legs grew. But all of those mutations have one thing in common, and that is that they don't help the animal. As a matter of fact, all the mutations, when they're plotted out, either fall into what is called a no selection zone, which means they have no effect at all, or the ones that do have an effect are harmful. We have never found a mutation in all the mutations that have been studied that actually helped the animal. But evolution says animals got better. They were helped. Well, our evidence doesn't match up with that. Mutations do not help. They hurt. So if mutations can't explain it, what else is put forth? Well, evolutionists will try to use the human eye as an example of evolutionary junk. They say, see, God couldn't have made the eye because it's made all wrong. They said the way it happened was there was just a nerve that had some photoreceptors at the surface, and then over millions of years, it sunk back in, got filled with a liquid, got a cornea, got a lens, all of those things just happened by random chance, and eventually we ended up with the eye that we have today. And they say the evidence that it just happened by evolution and not by creation is that the retina, the film in the back of your eye camera, is backwards. They say if God created it, he would have put the rods and cones, the light-sensitive cells, right up at the top so that the light coming in your eye would hit them first and you'd be able to see clearly. But they say in our eyes, the rods and cones, the light-sensitive nerves, are at the bottom of the retina. And to get to it, light has to go through all kinds of other cells first. And so they say, well, we ought to have lousy resolution in our eye. We should be able to see things clearly because our eye is upside down. What they are overlooking is something that's been known about since the 1800s, and that is a cell in the eye called the Müller cell. The Müller cell runs from the top of the retina down to the nerves at the bottom, and it is living fiber optics. Light enters it and travels through it at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, with absolutely no loss. It's like those fiber optic cables that we have. Things can travel through it. Light can travel through it no matter how it curves or whatever with no loss. We have these in our eye. And so when the light hits the retina, it travels through the Mueller cells down to the photoreceptors, the rods and cones, with absolutely no loss. It's a beautiful setup. It's not backwards at all. As a matter of fact, it works exactly the way it's supposed to work. Because once the light hits those rods and cones, if it reflected, bounced off of other things, it would burn out your eyes. So behind those receptors is a area of dark pigment. And that dark pigment there in the back, shown here as the retinal pigment, absorbs the light after it fires off the nerve cells. Perfect. Just exactly the way it needs to work in order to be successful. Some other facts about the eye that weren't in our lesson last week. You know, the eye is considered part of the brain. The eye begins to develop within 4 weeks of conception. It's one of the first things that begins to develop. Many newborns can move their eyes independently for a few months. If you have a newborn baby and their eyes start going different directions, nothing wrong with that. That's natural. For a few months, that happens sometimes. Our eyes can move more than 100,000 times in a day, especially if you're looking at a screen going back and forth. Dark-colored eye people generally have faster reactions than light-colored eye people. Brown eyes are better at tennis, and blue eyes are better at golf, because the brown eyes have faster reflexes. Tears contain bacteria-fighting chemicals. Even the tears are there to help cleanse the eye and keep infection out. Vitamin A is needed for proper working of the eye rods. That's why they say that a retinol or vitamin A is good for your eyes. Eat the carrots. You know, you never saw a rabbit wearing glasses. And rods can detect the light from a candle 25 miles away at night. How sensitive are our eyes? They can see the light from one candle 25 miles away. That's pretty sensitive. Didn't happen by chance. Too much that can't be explained on the basis of chance. And so the evolutionists say, well, if that's not proof, let's try something else. Let's try the tailbone. You know, the tailbone is, they say, the leftover of our ancestors, where we used to swing from the trees by our tails. And they say, that's all that's left. It really has no use. It used to be called a vestigial organ. Now we have found that it's not useless at all. As a matter of fact, it's very necessary, because fastened to it are at least three sets of muscles that form a floor for our abdomen. If we didn't have those, we couldn't stand upright, because all of our internal organs would just go down to the bottom and flop out. So we need muscles there to support it. It makes a floor to our abdomen. So all these things that evolutionists try to say are leftovers aren't leftovers. They have very necessary purposes. And then evolutionists tried this. They said, well, we know that dinosaurs turned into birds. Like the T-Rex, that type of dinosaur, became the chicken. Over millions of years, of course. I mean, don't they look alike? And they say, well, in order for that to happen, the dinosaur scales had to turn into feathers. Well, how does a scale turn into a feather? Well, the evolutionists will say, well, if you look at them under a microscope, they look very much alike. We saw in our lesson last week what they look like under the microscope. And, of course, you can't tell them apart. I mean, they look so similar. You see, the reptile scales are really folds in the skin, where a bird feather is a completely different setup. A bird feather, that's not what I'm looking for. Oh, well. The bird feather in the top picture, you see the big spine going down the middle. That is called the rachis of the feather. It's the main spine. Off of the main spine come side spines sticking out, sort of like branches off of the main trunk of a tree. Those side branches are called barbs. Coming out of the side branches are smaller limbs, smaller things called barbules. And if we look very closely under the microscope, we will see that those barbules have little hooks on them that hook into one another and hold the whole feather together. It's a very complex situation, this feather, where the reptile's scales are just skin folded up. These are very complex things. Now, we're going to see a little bit more about those today. And feathers grow from follicles, where the reptile scales are just skin. The feathers grow out of an individual follicle. Each feather grows from its own follicle, just like the hairs in mammals. Each of your hairs grows from its own follicle. And the follicle is a very complicated setup. On the bottom of our picture there, you see, on the bottom right-hand side, you see a picture of a hair, a magnified hair. It looks like it has scales on it, because it does. If you rub a hair one way, it feels smooth. If you rub it the other way, you can feel the scales on it. You can feel the roughness. It's designed that way. God made it that way. And you have different types of hairs. Vellus hairs and terminal hairs. We'll say a little bit about that after our lesson today. But, even the hairs on your head show the wonders of God's creation. So at this point, we want to take a look at a video, the second half of the video we saw last week. And he's going to concentrate here on feathers and hairs tonight and give you some information on that. So let me close this. Bring this up. And
follicles are tubes in the skin. Hair follicles and feather follicles, at least at first blush, look very similar. But no evolutionist believes that birds have anything to do with having evolved from mammals. And so they ignore the striking similarities between a feather and a hair. Now, I'm not suggesting birds did evolve from mammals, obviously. I think birds were created as birds on the fifth day of creation. Dinosaurs, by the way, were created on the sixth day, so you could have gotten birds from dinosaurs. But that's a feather follicle. In the center of the darker blue color is a feather cylinder, and down at the bottom is a growth tower. All of the growth occurs at the bottom, the same as in a hair follicle. It all sort of looks like this. Have you seen a pin feather? When the feathers first start growing out of a bird, they look like a fat pin sticking out of the skin. There's a shell over the feather. The feather is arranged in a cylindrical structure. You take the shell off and look at the image on the right. Down at the bottom, there's a little ring. And the shaft of the feather starts growing up from the ring on the back surface of the cylinder, as you see it here. And the little barbs you see starting in the front get longer and longer and move around the circle and join the shaft in the back as they grow up. And they end up taking these long helical roots from the shaft of the feather around to the crown. And so the barbs are really kind of up against the shaft like this, only helical. So when the shell breaks off, then the barbs can swing out like this and then out. And the whole thing just opens up, coming out of the feather. Let's look at a feather in its mature form. We're going to cut off a little piece of the feather vein on the left, as you see it there, and we're going to magnify that little piece, and that, let's say, will include three barbs that make up the feather. So the feather vein is made up of barbs. And let's look at a typical bird. Obviously, this varies all over the place, from a swan to a hummingbird. But average-sized bird, average feather will have one shaft or rachis, right? Right down the middle. Each shaft or rachis will have two veins, one on each side. Everybody with me? Okay. On an average feather, each vein will have about 400 barbs, of which you're looking at three. Hearts of three. And each of the 400 barbs, on average, will have 800 little barbs called barbules. Those are the ones you see in the three barbs that have been removed. Half the barbules point towards the tip of the feather. They're called anterior barbules. And half point more towards the base. They're called the posterior barbules. And then each of the anterior barbules has about 20 little hooklets on it. And these little hooklets work like Velcro. Only I looked at Velcro under the standing electron microscope. It really looks like junk. It's amazing it even attaches. But you look at God's Velcro, which is what feathers are all about, and you'll see some beautiful, beautiful engineering. In fact, let's do that. We'll start with a feather at low magnification. You see the shaft, a vein on each side of the shaft. You see the barbs that make up the vein. And you can kind of see the barbules that are crisscrossing between each barb. Now let's crank up the color a bit so you can see it closer. Now you can see this was a dirty bird. There's some dirt on it. We have the barbs going across the field, the left to right or right to left. And you can see the posterior barbels are on top and the anterior barbels are underneath, the crisscrossing between the barbs. You all with me on this so far? Okay, let's crank up the power a little more. We'll bring the shaft in to give you some orientation. So the rachis or shaft is kind of going across the lower right corner. You can see a couple of the barbs going straight up and out of the picture. And then the barbules that are on the top are the posterior barbels. And the barbules that are underneath are the anterior barbels. And it's the anterior barbels that have the hooks. But you can't see the hooks because the posterior barbels are covered. Let's crank up the power some more. Now you just see one barb going across the field. You see posterior barbels coming in from the top. You see anterior barbels going towards the top of the field from that barb. And again, those anterior barbels have the hooks, but you can't see them because the posterior barbels are covering them. So let's remove the posterior barbels. Now you see the hooks. Now notice where the barbules do not cover one another, there are little plates that fill in so the air can't get through there. And those little plates in some birds are covered with a double interference layer, which is like oil slick in water, that refracts the light to produce the beautiful iridescent colors that you see, for example, in the peacock scale. So there's a lot more going on here besides just a lot of gorgeous anatomy. Well, let's put it all together for you now. The anterior barbels are going from the lower left corner to the upper right corner. The posterior, they have the hooks, and the hooks are sticking up. You can see one right in the middle. The posterior barbels go the other direction, from the lower right-hand corner to the upper left. And if you look very carefully at the posterior barbels, you'll see there's a groove in them. It looks like a celery stick. And if you look at the lip on the groove, you will see that the radius of curvature of the lip precisely matches the hook. Oh, no, this is nice. Maybe get a screen door, and you want to put a hook on it with an eye. If that's no good, you go out and get a great big old hook and a little bit of an eye, or a great big eye and a little bit of a hook. They have to be a matched set. And the hook has to be the right length. Does no good for it to come out here. It needs to go there. So you see you have the hook, but the hook isn't hooked up. It's just kind of sticking in the air. So it's going to have a hinge to allow the hook to swing over. And when it swings over, it's got to land just right on the groove. And the lip of that groove has to be matching the radius of the hook. Well, let's take this whole thing and tip it over. We're looking at the other side of the feather now. Now the hooks are going down, not coming up. We'll crank up the power a little bit more. Can you see the hooks there? Oh, there's so much beautiful anatomy in here. If you look, the barbels have a little strut running down the back that strengthens them. It's sort of like a jumper strut on the mast of the sailboat, the spreaders. The hooks are disengaged at this point. Let's go to the highest power I'm going to bother to show you right here. And there you see three of the hooks that are engaged from the anterior barbel onto the grooves of the posterior barbel. Notice one of the hooks actually has a little guiding probe that guides the hook in. And if you look at the base of the last hook on the right up there, you can see the nature of the hinge. It's a strap hinge. That would be a hinge sort of like this. It allows the hook to move in this axis, but it doesn't allow it to move laterally because strap hinges don't move that way. They just go like this. As you can see, basically a reptile scale. You know, I'm wondering, could I even give this lecture at a biology department? I mean, would this be like teaching religion, showing how unrelated a feather and a seal? Well, we're simply going to have to simplify this lecture. Things are getting way too complicated. So let's look at a hair. Bible tells us our hairs are all numbered. And if you make something as beautiful, you'd number it too. There is a human hair. In fact, that human hair, I actually plucked from my scalp several years ago when I could afford this kind of thing. The hair has cuticle on it. Looks like shingles on a roof. Little shingles. And those shingles are what makes a hair shirt itch. Wasn't that worth the whole trip down here to learn why a wolf spider itches? And if you take a hair and pluck it from your head, if you start from the tip of the hair and slide your fingers to the base, you'll feel resistance, sneaky resistance. But if you start from the base and go to the tip, it's smooth. It's because one way you're plucking the cuticle, one way you're going with it. And the cuticle is very important because it wraps around some kind of stick-like cells, bundles of sticks inside the hair that are also dead. They're called cortical cells. And it keeps the hair together because if the cuticle were to break off, the cortical cells would split. You've got it split ends. The most incredible function of the cuticle, however, is that if God would have given us monofilament nylon, the same diameter as hair, and put that in our head, we would really have a problem. You ever get a snag in monofilament line fishing? Break out the scissors and cut it off because you're never getting that snarl out. But with the cuticle, when one hair turns on the other, they kind of lock horns and you can comb it right out again. In fact, companies that make natural hair wigs have to get all the hairs facing the same way or you can't groom the hair. And then, finally, that cuticle forms the most incredible thing you can think of, and that's a hair lock. Did you know you have a hair lock? Oh, let's get into that. Well, let's start out from the beginning. And if you look very closely at her face, you can see that there are three types of hairs. Actually, you'll see two on her face. One would be the terminal hairs. These are the black hairs that you can see, the ones we usually think about. They're called terminal hairs. They're pigmented, they're various lengths, but usually plenty long enough to see. But you realize that on her cheek, she has as many hairs per square inch as she does on her head. She has as many hairs per square inch on her nose as she does on her head. These little hairs are called vellus hairs. They're very tiny, they're colorless, and they have big oil glands, which is why that kind of skin is oily. Now, when you're born, you have every hair you are ever going to have. You never lose a hair or gain a hair. And the follicles are able to make different kinds of hair, just as feathers can be made, different feathers during different times of the year for birds. We can make different kinds of hairs. A given follicle can make a terminal hair, or it can make a vellus hair. So when we think we're losing hair, we really aren't losing hair, just the terminal hair fell out once, and instead of another one growing into its place, a vellus hair grew in. And then to add insult to injury, you not only get a bald pate, but it gets to be a shiny pate because of those big oil glands. Actually, all the hairs of our body begin life as a lanugo hair. This is the place-centered hair, and all follicles make a lanugo hair first. If you see a baby that's born premature, this happens to be my little grandson who was born at 7 months of development, and you can see the hair on his arms. Now, of course, evolutionists look at that and say, well, there you go, that reflects our ape ancestry. You know, nobody calls my grandchild an ape. So the lanugo hair is the first hair to form. And it always forms in association with nerves, because hairs are actually mechanical receptors attached to nerves. So when you wiggle a hair, you're jangling a nerve. And so even the little hairs, the little vellus hairs of our body, when the wind blows past our face, we get a laminal flow that moves those little hairs, and we get that refreshing sense of breeze. Something gets close to your skin, you can just feel it kind of tingles. People say these little vellus hairs have no function. Well, they have a function, it's just not a very dramatic function, but our body's full of things that are nice but not necessary. Well, there's a hair growth cycle. Hair grows for a while, like toothpaste coming out of a tube. After growing for a while, it stops growing, goes into a resting phase, and then after a few weeks, it starts growing again. The important thing is the old hair gets kicked out of the follicle, and the new hair grows in behind it. If this weren't the case, hair would grow so long, stop, and grow so long, and stop, and grow and stop, and just get longer and longer. Can you imagine a squirrel's going through the trees dragging 15 feet of hair? But the important thing is when the old hair falls out, a new one will come in behind it. And it won't fall out until a new one starts growing in. So when you see hairs in the sink, good news, bad news. The good news is that hair wouldn't be in the sink if it weren't for the fact there's a new hair growing in behind it. What could be the bad news? The new one could be a vellus hair. So anyway, that's the way the follicles look in the skin. Anatomically, they're really complex. There's like 8 concentric rings that are forming the various layers of the hair and the follicle. And several years ago, I did some work where I took skin and sectioned hairs. You actually say I split hairs. You can see the lower part of the hair has living cells in it, and the upper part of the hair is dead. And there is a locking mechanism. We'll look at it by magnifying that area right there. There's a locking mechanism right there, and on the surface of the hair, you can barely make it out, but there's like little shingles there. And then lining the hair follicle, the tube in which the hair grows, it has another set of shingle-like cells. Let's take a look at this. The lower half of the field is the hair. You're seeing its cut surface. It's been cut down its length. And you can see these tiles that are the cuticle cells of the hair. And then the upper half of the field, the lighter tissue there, is the lining of the hair follicle. It has a cuticle facing the opposite direction. Get the picture? It's like a ratchet. The two are interlocked. They are so interlocked that if you try to pull a hair out of the follicle, you're going to take about two-thirds of the follicle with it. Try it. Pull it out of your head, you'll feel a knob on the end. So this is kind of a drawing of the way it looks. Aligning the hair follicle is a cuticle. On the surface of the hair, an orange is a cuticle. And the two interlock. So you just can't pull a hair out. There is a cuticle lining the follicle tube. And it's that cuticle that locks the hair in the follicle. Let's crank up the power one more time. Now you're looking at the innermost layer of the hair follicle. If you look at the right about in the center to the left there of the coating cells, you'll see what looks like a kind of a little donut. That's a red blood cell. Give you an idea of the magnification. And look how closely that cuticle locks. If you peel it away, you can see every little nook and cranny on the hair matches every little step on the lining lock. Now, this ought to be raising some questions for you. If there's a mailing tube around the hair, as it were, that's dead, that has a cuticle on it, that's locked into the cuticle of the hair, how does the hair grow? Because it's being locked in. I mean, it's great. You can grab an apple by the hair, you can't just pull it out. If it wouldn't be for this lock, you could just pull hair out like this. I don't think any mammal would survive without the lock, at least other than man. And so the lock locks the hair in the follicle. A person can be lifted off the ground by your hair, if you weigh a little less than I do, and have a little bit more hair. But the thing that's really incredible is the lock is like that red tube you're seeing in this picture. That lock actually holds that hair in there, and the only way that hair can grow is the lock has to move with the hair. You think, well, wait a minute, if the lock moves with the hair, And then you're back to the original problem of the hair being able to be pulled right out of the follicle. Ah, but there are millions and millions of little buttons that button and unbutton, button and unbutton, button and unbutton, all along the lock, sequentially, to allow the hair to grow and still be under control. My friends, we're talking about a hair. This should be easy. Can evolutionists explain a hair? I don't know. Let's look and see. This is an evolutionist explaining the origin of hair. The elegant complexity of the hair follicle, which at first seemed so difficult to explain in evolutionary terms, may be readily explained. It permits good rod to grow from a big hole. A mere refinement, which could have occurred quite late in the phylogeny of hair. The model which has been presented is highly speculative, but this is inevitable due to the nature of the subject. And this is science. Well, let's conclude. We've talked about feathers and birds, and we've talked about hairs, and so the Lord talked about feathers and hairs in Matthew 10, verse 29 and 31. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father, and even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid, you're worth more than many sparrows.